This is Chris Young, co-author of Modernist Cuisine. I'd like to invite you to check out chefsteps.com. It's a free website we've created as a place to learn new cooking techniques and collaborate with curious cooks from around the world. Sign up now at chefsteps.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Nokomis, Florida, where I'm down here in Florida for my Uncle Luke's 100th birthday party. How you guys all doing over there? Who I got in the studio with me today?
Peter and Estacia.
Hey, Stas, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
All right, what'd you do?
Went to the beach.
Yeah? Which beach?
Westport, yesterday. Yeah. I mean, Sunday.
Westport, Connecticut?
Yeah.
Westport, Connecticut?
Yeah.
People actually go to Westport, Connecticut for a vacation?
It was just a day trip on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've been down here waiting for my Uncle Luke to turn 100, which he did today. Right after the radio show, I'm going over there for his actual party.
Nice. Peter's
and,
here.
What did you say?
Peter's here.
What's up, Dave?
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
I'm all right, man.
Yeah? How much can you hear the weed whacker going on in the background?
Zero.
Oh, nice. The crazy burnouts that run this joint that I'm at in Nokomis can't seem to get the internet working, but they do have a weed whacker, a nice gas-powered weed whacker. So, Peter, why don't we talk about the state of the MOFAD Kickstarter before we get into questions. For those of you that don't know and are listening to this, MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, has a Kickstarter up now called Boom, where we're trying to get our puffing gun. Puffing gun is the old way they used to make puff cereals by heating grains up to... well, not tremendous, but high pressures and temperatures, about 180 PSI, and then releasing that pressure suddenly and having all the moisture inside instantly evaporate and bang, puff the grains very uniformly. But apparently it works on things other than grains that we're going to try out, things like hemp chips, things like peppercorns. Anyway, we have a Kickstarter going to try and raise the funds in a crowdsourced manner to build out an actual exhibit that we can travel around with. The Kickstarter now, we need about 80 grand to do it, and right now we're about 34 grand. So what I need everyone to do is not just, because I know a lot of our listeners have already donated, but I need people to go and find their friends and relatives and other people, like-minded individuals, to come on the Kickstarter and back it. And it's not just to give away your money and you get nothing. We're talking awesome T-shirts, awesome tote bags, parties. I mean, if you have a lot of cash jangling around in your pocket, we'll make a custom cereal for you. But the idea here is that we want to crowdsource this to show that we have a broad level of support. So it's very important that you go and you find people to go and back us if they just want a T-shirt or anything else. But that's my feeling about it. We have about 10 days left on the Kickstarter, so we need to gear into high gear now after the holidays are over. Peter, what are your thoughts on it? Peter, by the way, Peter Kim is the executive director of the Museum of Food and Drink, the leader of the project, I guess. So Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, so first of all, if you want to check out our Kickstarter, you can go to boom.mofad.org. That's boom.mofad.org. Yeah, I think Dave really, you did a great job encapsulating it. I mean, we're really excited about this Kickstarter. It's not just about kickstarting one exhibit, but it's actually about kickstarting the whole museum. You know, the plan for MOFAD right now is to challenge the traditional museum model and actually create a mobile pop-up museum, and this will be our first exhibit. And so, you know, as Dave said, what we're trying to do is drum up a lot of public support, and I think this will open up a lot of doors for us and help us get, you know, propel us towards our ultimate goal of opening up a brick-and-mortar museum filled with exhibits like this. So we really, really need your help. I mean, this is like a, it's hard to overstate this, but it's a labor of love. We have a lot of volunteers working on this. I was working until like 3 a.m. last night, woke up at 5 this morning, got right back up to work on it. We're pushing hard on this because we believe in this. We really think it's the time is right to create a food museum that, you know, encourages people and inspires people to think a lot about, you know, the choices that they make and how food connects to the world around us.
Right. Let me stress, most museums start, right? They start with one of two things, either a large collection or a very rich person, right? Very few museums are trying to start the way we're trying to start, which is as an idea, you know, and then getting the funding from a broad range of support that wasn't already present. And so that's why I think it's very important that everyone go out and find their buddies. And by the way, just because you don't live in New York City, don't think we aren't going to bring the puffing gun to a neighborhood near you at some point. The idea is, after we get it funded and we test out the gun in New York, to do a traveling roadshow to other areas of the country. We probably can't take it internationally at this point, but we are planning on taking it to other parts of the country. True or false, Peter?
Absolutely true. And I wouldn't actually rule out international just yet. But, you know, after the puffing gun, we have just, you know how Dave's brain works. We've got about 1.5 million ideas for the next pop-up exhibits. And after we create a few of these, you know, we're going to be able to take those wherever we can drive them. And that's really exciting that we're not going to have to just be stuck in one place.
Yeah, and you should go and check out our video anyway. We have an incredible cavalcade of awesome, smart, and famous people shilling out for us on the video. So go check it out. Anyway, we'll probably harp on that a couple more times.
Yeah, so boom.mofad.org, boom.mofad.org.
All right, let me hit a few of the questions we have in here. One, hey, Cooking Issues crew, I'm trying to help my pops impart Thai basil into his cooking. Fresh and finishing applications aren't doing the trick for him. I've read that you can freeze Thai basil and break it up before laying it under a protein that you are cooking. He also wanted to explore getting a mortar and pestle to release the oils or infuse cooking oil with it. Can you speak to the scientific aspect of working with more delicate herbs for maximum flavor? Thanks so much. Billy Rose Patterson, the manager of Alamo Drafthouse Cinema in Yonkers. I haven't been to Yonkers in a long time. Drive through Yonkers because it's on the way to my mom's house, who lives up north of the city, but haven't stopped by the Yonkers in a long time. Peter, you ever hang out in Yonkers?
I've never been. Always been fascinated by the name, though.
Well, Yonkers, we know Yonkers, aside from being kind of the first city on the left hand side as you travel north, up there, and the childhood home of one of my sculpture mentors, John Kessler. You know, we always heard, like, you know, Yonkers Raceway. That's where, like, I think the monster trucks used to go. So, like, when I used growing up listening to monster trucks, those guys were all in Yonkers, but no one ever took me to go see them. Sad, right?
Sad.
Have you ever seen a demolition derby, Dave?
I have not been to a demolition derby, but I've always wanted to go to a demolition derby, and I've also always wanted to go to a figure eight racing competition. You know figure eight racing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where they race in a figure eight and they smash in the middle. Amazing stuff. Crazy. I can't believe they do that. Anyway, whatever. That's not worth it. You know, they do that now. They have figure eight racing with school buses. Were you aware of this?
No.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's sick, dude. It's like decommissioned school buses, and they probably fill the sides of it with concrete and stuff so they can keep going for a long time. And then the school buses are going as fast as they can around this tiny figure eight track without flipping over and then occasionally smashing into each other. I mean, I can't think of much cooler than that, except for maybe Mofad's puffing gun.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. Boom. All right, so the issue with Thai basil... and I think you hit the nail on the head. Thai basil is an extremely fragile herb. Now, Thai basil, for those of you that don't use it, is it's akin to, you know, kind of the globe Italian basil. It's more common here in the U.S., but it I like it quite a lot. It's not really used for the same applications. It has a bit of an anise note, but if you're not a friend of anise-flavored things, don't let that put you off. It's not like overpowering or like a pastis kind of thing, but it has a definite anise-flavored note, and it's what we use at the bar for our Thai basil daiquiris. I like it a lot. I think it's very good, by the way, in drink applications, but the problem with Thai basil, even as opposed to regular globe basil, which is the Italian one that we are more used to, is extremely fragile. It goes off very, very quickly. And by that, I mean it turns black, and the enzymes in it are very, very fast, almost as fast as they are in mint, and turning the leaves kind of black. And so it's difficult to do things with them and have them stay fresh for as long as you would with something like even with regular basil, which turns black very quickly as well. So the problem is that anything that you're going to do with it, for instance, freezing it, if you freeze Thai basil, when it thaws, as soon as it thaws, it'll turn black because the freezing is going to rupture the cells rupture some of the cells, the ice crystals, and then when it thaws out, polyphenol oxidase enzymes in it will instantly go to work and turn the sucker swampy and black. So if you were going to do something, like one thing you can do is to, I've never dried Thai basil, so I'm kind of talking out of the wrong side of my body at this point, but I'm sure you could dry it in the same way that they dry herbs, perhaps in the microwave. I've never tried it. Or, and it's not so good, but if you were going to freeze it, you could blanch them. The problem is if you blanch them, which kills the enzymes, you definitely change the flavor and you lose a lot of that freshness. If you freeze them very quickly and then never let them thaw again and then blend them in to something that doesn't have a lot of oxygen, you might be able to get around the problem of it browning. But it really is just a kind of a delicate herb that kind of needs a little bit of care to work. Now, you can cook with it. It's fine. If you want that fresh, I mean, it's great. I shouldn't say fine. It's great. Stas, you ever cook with it? Or Peter, you ever cook with Thai basil?
No.
All the time. I love it.
Yeah, right. I mean, you can cook with it like you can cook with any basil, but if you want that fresh flavor, it's very hard to do anything to. That's why we go through all the trouble of freezing with liquid nitrogen and blending it with alcohol, which kills the polyphenol oxidase. Now, like I say, if you freeze it, then if you're going to blend it into something, a sauce, a mortar pestle and oil, you might want to sprinkle a little ascorbic acid on it before you do that to try and inhibit the browning that's going to happen almost instantly as it thaws out. Or you might try muddling it with a little bit of super high-proof ethanol to keep it green before you incorporate the oil and whatnot. But just remember, if it freezes and then thaws, as soon as it thaws out, it's going to turn black, unless you prevent it by blanching, which not kills the fresh flavor, but alters it, or hit it with some sort of antioxidant, or something that inactivates the enzymes, like high-proof ethanol, something like that. That make sense, guys?
Yep.
Yeah, all right, cool. Dave, Nastasha, Joe, Jack, et al., which I guess includes Peter today. I purchased a small deep fryer late last year and regrettably haven't used it that much. It is regrettable to have a deep fat fryer and not use it. Although I will say that small deep fryers are nowhere near as awesome. I mean, like, they're not even in the same league of awesome as commercial deep fat fryers. However, the summer after I graduated from college, I did only three things. I watched daytime TV, including Regis and Kelly, all the way through up to General Hospital soap operas. I watched the whole thing. And worked on my 76 Bonneville, which required a lot of Bondo work, and spray painting it gold and whatnot. And I deep-fried French fries and habanero chili rellenos in my little deep-fryer fry daddy. So they do work. Anyway, I purchased a small deep-fryer late last year. Regrettably, haven't used it that much. 4 months ago, I left the oil in it last time I used it after skimming out the solids. And you got to be careful. You want to cover it so light doesn't get to it. And one of the problems with small fryers and storing oil in them for long periods of time is that they have a poor surface area to volume ratio. And so it's the surface area of oxygen transfer to volume that's going to determine how fast the oil oxidizes and goes rancid on you. So they're not really ideal in that sense because they have a fairly large surface area. Anyway, okay. So after skimming the solids, 3 months ago, I spooned in some solidified bacon fat, thinking it was a clever way to store it, and I would deep fry something and get a great smoky bacon flavor in the next week or so. 3 months later, the bacon fat and oil are still in the deep fryer. Question, is it okay to fry chicken with this oil-bacon fat combo for the 4th of July or not? Well, I'm a little late to help you on that, but anyway. I understand possible rancidity of bacon bits from bacon grease could create a flavor issue, but if I bring it up to 350, are there any potential health issues with trying some fried bread to check for rancidity? Thanks, Tommy Bishop, Wyethville, VA. Wyethville, VA. I don't think it's, I can't think of any major health problems, but the issue with bacon grease in general, I mean, I save it, but it goes off pretty quickly because remember, there's a lot of salt in bacon, and the salt is really going to increase the rate, especially because bacon grease is usually heated to a very high temperature when you're cooking the bacon. So you're starting to break down the fats there. You have salt in it, which is starting to break down the fats. And so, in general, bacon grease isn't your most stable of fats. that said, you know, it's not going to kill you to eat it. It's just a question of, is it still going to taste good, right? What do you think, guys? Think that's anyone, well, any thoughts? Not paying attention. Okay, so, but,
I mean,
that person's probably already done this
or hasn't done it, so.
What do you say?
I guess we could just ask the person who asked the question because they probably tried it.
Well, 4th of July.
But again, Tommy is pointing out my favorite test for frying oils is putting a cube of bread into them, frying them, and then tasting the bread to see whether or not it has a, whether it tastes like crap. Because bread's very neutral, bread absorbs a lot of oil, and then you can get a real feel for kind of what's going on with the bread. So that's a good way of doing it. It's not going to kill you. I mean, there are probably people who say that the free fatty acids aren't good for you and all this other stuff, but I don't know that I'm a real believer in it. I haven't seen any data that says that, you know, you're going to substantially shorten your lifespan by having a little bit of bacon grease that's gone a little bit over the hill, you know?
Hey, Dave, anyway. What's the lifespan of the oil in your massive fryer?
Very long. So oil, there's a couple of things. So I have a 35-pound deep fryer that takes about 6 gallons of oil, about 5.5, 6 gallons of oil. And it's stored in a very tall format. And additionally, because deep fryers are tall and have a fairly small surface area for how deep they are. And the other thing about, and so that right there for storage is kind of ideal. The other great thing about commercial deep fryers that use tubes, called tube fryers, is that the oil at the bottom stays relatively cool, and also particles that come off of your food as you're frying sink to the bottom into relatively cooler oil instead of in traditional stovetop frying where the particles hit the bottom of the pan, which is the hottest part of the pan. Right? In addition, the surface area of heating in a tube fryer is so high that it doesn't overheat the oil too much because it has such a large surface area for transfer. So it keeps the oil at a much more stable temperature, and stability of temperature is much better for oil stability over time. You don't overheat it to get to the temperature you're going to cook, and therefore that greatly enhances the length of time the oil lasts. It has a smaller surface area on top, so that greatly increases the length of time that it will last. And the burnt particles are kept at the bottom while you're frying, which greatly increases. So all in all, just much, 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 much better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. So, hey, Dave, Nastasha et al. From Timothy. I came across this video of a guy making crepes in Kowloon Walled City. I think it's pronounced Kowloon. It's in Hong Kong. Any idea what's going on? It's a YouTube video. Now, I had no idea what Kowloon Walled City is. Have you guys heard of this before? I looked it up. Have you guys heard of this?
No.
No.
So Kowloon Walled City, when the British, I don't really even know how they got Hong Kong in the first place, through some form of coercion or whatnot, but when they gained control of Hong Kong, In the early 1800s or early mid 1800s, China maintained control of certain areas of Hong Kong, including parts of Kowloon, where they had a fort, so they could see what the Brits were gonna do. In the late 1800s, when the Brits, decided to alter the deal, as Darth Vader would say, they took over control of Kowloon, the walled city of the fort, and then didn't do much with it, and it stayed relatively lawless. It also stayed relatively unpopulated until after World War II and the fall of mainland China. It also had a big influx during the Japanese occupation in World War II, and then after World War II, after the communist takeover of mainland China, it just got swamped with people and still maintained no laws. So until that, and then it just got kind of crazier and crazier until at one point in this little 6-acre place, 30,000 people were living with no law, and like, literally no law, except the triads, which, you know, are the kind of their mafia over there. And so it was just insane. If you see pictures of it, it's like no light made it down into the bottom of it because people would just build kind of illegal walkways. People would bring in illegal electricity. It was just crazy. It was like free-for-all, like Mad Max kind of thing.
Or it sounds like the Five Points.
What do you say?
Or like the Five Points.
Yeah, right. Kind of like Five Points. And much like Five Points, which was incredibly vilified in the press at the time, the vast majority of people who... Five Points was the big gang area downtown New York in the 1800s. Much like that, the majority of people who lived there were just living kind of normal lives, and not, you know, and just trying to you know make a living and do whatever they needed to do. So anyways, the I need to move again because now there is a leaf blower. So anyways, what happened is that they kicked everyone out. And then they tore the whole thing down. The same thing they did to the Five Points, actually. So it's almost an exact analog to Five Points. But there's a German documentary of it that was done prior to when they tore it down in the 90s, and they evicted everyone, I guess, in the late 80s. And in that video, you can see people just going about their daily business, like making noodles and making what isn't really crepes, which is what's pointed out in the video, but spring roll wrappers. And spring roll wrappers have a very interesting manufacturing technique, because what you do, instead of making a standard crepe dough, so in a standard crepe dough, you do a very high hydration dough, like 1-to-1 hydration of a liquid to flour. You let it rest and hydrate and let all the air bubbles come out, and then you pour it on a very hot griddle with oil. You put oil down the griddle, you pour it down a very hot griddle, and you use a little kind of what looks like a spatula rake. I forget what the term in French is. It's like raclette or something like that. Peter will help me out because his French is much better than mine. And you swirl it around into a crepe, you let the bottom cook, and you flip it. Spring roll, by contrast, is a much less hydrated dough. I don't really know what they use, but it looks like maybe 75% hydration or maybe a little higher, and it sticks to your hand. And you knead it to build up the gluten. Use a high gluten flour. You knead it to build up the gluten, and then you let it rest for an hour or so before you use it to let it hydrate. And then you get a fairly low temperature griddle, right? And I don't think you want to oil it. I'm not sure. I don't think you want to oil it. Then you grab the dough in your hand, and you have this lump of sticky dough in your hand, and you mash it onto the griddle, and you wipe it around in like a wax on, wax off movement, for those of you that have seen Karate Kid, and then you pull the dough off, and just a thin layer sticks on your griddle. And then after a couple moments, it dries out, because it's very thin, and after it dries out, it self-releases from the griddle in the same way that rice will release off the sides of a pan if you let it dry overnight. But you don't want it to turn brown, so you're not browning it, right? So it's very low temperature, probably somewhere in the 200s Fahrenheit, in that range. And you're just making spring roll wrapper after spring roll wrapper. But it's a pretty cool technique. I don't think I've tried it. I can't remember whether I've ever tried it. If I have tried it, it would have been decades ago. But it is a cool technique. You ever tried that, either of you guys?
No.
Nope.
You like yourself a spring roll?
Yeah.
Loving my spring rolls.
Yeah, everyone likes a spring roll, right?
I like spring rolls wrapped in lettuce. The combo is good for me.
That's more of a lettuce roll, isn't it?
Well, it's a roll within a roll.
Oh, you mean you like an actual spring roll with the wrapper and then wrap again in lettuce?
Yeah.
Is that because of the whole, like, you know, Korean thing? You have to wrap everything in lettuce, you're not happy?
I can pretty much take anything, wrap it in lettuce, and love it. But I really like the contrast of the crispy spring roll and then with the fresh lettuce. It makes me happy.
So, in other words, you would prefer... you like a fried spring roll, or you like them, like, still kind of... You like them fried, like egg roll style, fried hard,
wrapped
in lettuce? Or you like them soft, wrapped in lettuce?
In that case, fried.
Fried, then wrapped in lettuce.
Yep.
You should fry it, then wrap it in an unfried one, and then wrap it in lettuce. See how many layers you can go. By the way, this might be a good point to bring this up. I don't know if we brought it up before, but I'll see whether Nastasha and Peter and the guys in the booth agree with me. I hate wraps. I hate wraps. For as much as I hate, like, spring roll, as much as I love tortillas of almost any variety, although I do prefer corn for most applications, wraps suck. They really are bad. Everyone needs to walk around and then every once in a while, like, think about the fact that wraps are so popular here in the U.S. And they're really just, viciously bad. They're horribly, horribly bad. I mean, if you think about this, you're taking an undercooked flour tortilla, which if you were going to do any reasonable kind of cooking, you would reheat on a griddle to kind of make it taste more cooked, right? And then serve it right away in some sort of cooked thing. And instead, you're wrapping it with a bunch of other dense, wet crap. right? And then wrapping it in such a way, almost invariably, that you have too much kind of floury mess on one section and not enough in another, and serving to someone as though it's something they should eat. Have we discussed this before, Nastasha, on the air?
I think so.
Well, it kind of bears repeating. Peter, we've never discussed it before. What do you think? Am I off base here with my rap hatred?
No, my soul just crumbled away a little bit, just imagining biting into one of those cold, mealy, crumbly tortilla things. Like, it's, yeah. Not
yeah,
good.
So somewhere, at some point, right, and I can't remember when the rap thing happened, but I remember before there were raps, right? So, like, you know, when I was a little boy, we didn't get raps. That didn't happen, right? That was not on the radar. So some point between the late 70s and the mid-90s, some person who hates food, some person who absolutely detests all that is good in life, came up with this kind of horrible, rancid idea and has perpetrated it on hundreds of millions of us, because we've all been served one of these nonsense raps before. And I think, you know, right after you back the MOFAD Kickstarter, go tell a friend not to buy raps. You know what I'm saying?
I will say this. You know, a lot of times, so back when I was working as an attorney, you know, we'd have these business meetings, right? And there'd be catered food. And I'll be honest, a lot of times I opted for the wrap over the sandwich simply because I didn't want to make a mess and it was just easier to eat. I still didn't like it. I still prefer a sandwich. I don't necessarily think that this was a crime against humanity, as you're suggesting, but, you know, there is something to be said about how it keeps your hands clean.
All right, well, okay, so let's go on this for a second. That's true. However, here's the thing. A poorly made sandwich, right, is still better than a well-made wrap, right? But the problem is that it's very hard to actually construct a sandwich for best taste and also best eatability. You know what I mean? So most people, they'll overstuff the hell out of their sandwich, and then it tastes good because the fillings almost always taste good, but it's completely uneatable in a kind of a friendly, or not friendly, but a public or business environment, because the stuff's going to be falling all over your plate all the time. The flip side is people that manufacture sandwiches for either maximum eatability or their maximum crazy harebrained idea of health, right? Like, those guys, when they make the sandwich, it's like horribly dry. And like, a dry sandwich makes me almost as sad, maybe in some situations more sad, because it could be so much better with a simple addition of the condiment like mayonnaise or oil as a wrap. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think
like
the solution...
How sad is a dry sandwich? How sad are these two things? A dry sandwich or an undersalted sandwich where someone made the chicken salad and they didn't put enough salt in the chicken salad, and it's also a little too dry, and they pack it on that like horribly badly made wheat bread that they think is good for you, but it's not because it tastes bad.
And there's like the bread to filling combo is just way off. I mean, I think the solution really for this is to have tea sandwiches at all business meetings. I love tea sandwiches.
Tea sandwiches are good. That's a good business meeting compromise.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the other issue with bad sandwiches, you know, there's so much bad, like so much of the kind of things that are put out for people to eat are horrible. I mean, I don't know what got me into this mood, but here's another one for you. When you wrap a breadstick with ham, right, you got to realize that, especially the thin breadsticks, like their ability to stay crisp is extremely minimal, because any amount of water at all migrates out of that ham into that breadstick. And now you have like a mealy, gooey breadstick, and then you have to try and extricate this ham from around it. People need to think about moisture migration and putting different products together. They're going to sit around for a long time when they're worrying about catering things like business lunches. What are your thoughts on the breadsticks and ham?
Just moisture migration ignorance.
Yeah.
Agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think
I would describe it that way myself.
In this episode, just kind of like, I'm just throwing a bunch of hate downs for no reason.
I mean, I agree with you in spirit, you know? I'm right there with you. Just perhaps the magnitude is you're further out there than me.
Well, I also noticed that what you're telling me is that at the business meeting, you're too much of a sissy to take the sandwich that you like and instead taking the rep.
Oh, the hate's being directed this way now.
Yeah, yes, yes. Well, you know, if you ever come work, anyone who's listening, if you ever come work with us, you got to realize there's going to be a certain amount of hate down getting thrown around at all times. We just can't, we can't help a little bit of the friendly hate down here at either at MOFAD or Booker and Dax or Cooking Issues. Anyway, we got to take a quick commercial break.
Sure.
All right. Here's the break coming back. Cooking Issues.
This one is called Fish Is Vodka by the Meatballers on Cooking Issues.
This is Chris Young, co-author of Modernist Cuisine. Together with photographer Ryan Matthew Smith and chef Grant Crilly, we've created something exciting and new at chefsteps.com. Each day in our kitchen at Seattle's Pike Place Market, we're working on new recipes, as well as updating classic ones that we love. And we're always looking for new techniques that make the impossible possible. At chefsteps.com, we publish it all online, with detailed step-by-step demonstrations, as well as explanations of the science that answers the why behind the how in the kitchen. And through our forum, you can engage with our team, as well as a friendly community of curious cooks from around the world. If you're interested in becoming a better cook, if you want more from the creative team behind Modernist Cuisine, and if, like us, you're a fan of Dave Arnold and Cooking Issues, then we think there's a lot you'll like. And the best part? ChefSteps.com is entirely free to learn.
And welcome back to Cooking Issues. Here today with Peter Kim, head of MOFAD, Nastasha, and the engineering crew. Call in your questions. You still have some time. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So we have this one in comment, really, from Andrea Perotti from the UK. And this one, Peter, you're going to want to listen to it. It has to do with MOFAD. I'm a longtime reader of the blog and listener of the show. My girlfriend and I have followed the recent MOFAD development and are very excited about this project, especially the Puffing Gun exhibit. I'm a nutrition science student currently working at Kellogg's as a junior nutritionist on our UK team. I'm sure you guys won't need it, but if you'd like any information or any help of any kind, I'd be happy to contribute in any way I can. I'm not a huge manufacturing expert, but I work closely with the R&D team, and I'd be happy to let give you any information should you need it. So I guess, you know, who knows what we need, right, Peter?
Oh, yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So, yeah, you should definitely contact us at info@mofad.org, and we'll definitely get in touch with you.
Here's the best part. Best of luck in obtaining the full amount for the Puffing Gun. We recently made a small donation, but are spreading the word to all of our family and friends. So Andrea is doing exactly the right thing, which is spreading the word to
Thank
all
you.
The family and friends.
Dave, you have a caller.
We have a caller? Mm-hmm. Caller, you're on. Oops. Hey, can you guys hear? I can't hear what's going on.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi.
Howdy. Hello?
Hi.
Hello.
Caller.
It's Dave.
Hello. Hi.
Howdy doody, what's your question?
Hi, sorry, I didn't think you could hear me. I'm calling about, long-time listener, love the show. Calling about thickening yogurt. I'm wondering, I want to, like, take yogurt and add fruit puree to it, but it loses a lot of its viscosity, and I'm wondering if I can use something like agar or carrageenan to thicken it so that I can, like, form canals with spoons.
Well, you can thicken yogurts with carrageenan. It's done all the time. The issue is that, you know, carrageenan needs to be heated, you know, pretty hot, almost all the way up to the boil for it to really get to get active. Now, what you can do is heat the carrageenan in, and I would use, so cap the carrageenan is stiff and brittle. and it doesn't reform after it's broken, whereas iota carrageenan is much more kind of stretchy, and it also reforms gel. So a lot of times people will use a mix of kappa and iota for things like thickening yogurt, and you can use a very small amount because carrageenan is very synergistic with dairy systems. And so, yeah, I think a lot of the times people would probably add the stuff before the thickening because they can then heat it without heating the yogurt up to a certain to a high temperature. But what you could do is over, heat the yogurt slightly, and then it'll kill the cultures though. And then over, overdose some actual straight milk, and then stir that in, let it gel, and then set up further. Alternatively, you could take a live yogurt, make like a firmer iota, and then stir it in just before it sets when it's warm but not too hot, and then let it set like that and then let it culture up a little more, and you should be able to get a gel. The other thing, though, is if you really want to thicken it up, just hang it, put it into an actual fine cheesecloth, not the wretched they sell in the supermarket, and let moisture drip out of the yogurt for a good long time. And you'll drip out a bunch of the moisture, and it'll thicken up quite a bit, and then you won't have as much of a problem when you mix the fruit purees back into it, because you'll just be taking it back to where it once was.
Right. Okay. How much carrageenan do you typically use for, say, like X amount of something like yogurt? Because you said you use small amounts, right?
What'd you say?
You generally typically use like very little, right?
Yeah. Well, in dairy systems, carrageenan is roughly five times more powerful than it is in water-based systems. I mean, the numbers get a little dicey when you get down to those kind of very low percentages, but you can, in general, use like on the order of 2 grams per kilo, something in that range, and get a pretty decent gel with them. Piper Christensen, who works with us at Booker and Dax, did a stint at working R&D at CP Kelco, who does a lot of the good carrageenans. So what we'll have him do, he's in Vietnam right now, but when he gets back from Vietnam, I'll just ask him for a good yogurt thickening recipe and have him tweet it out, and I'll retweet it for it on our Cooking Issues Twitter feed before next week's show.
Awesome. That would be amazing. Thanks a lot. Love the show. Love everyone there. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, no worries.
So, all right. So Andrea made a comment back from the person who works at Kellogg's in the UK, and this is the apropos part also for Peter. The nutrition coverage on the show is limited but always very interesting and usually aligned with my personal opinions. There are not so many shows, programs, or print media publications that really value evidence-based nutrition like you do. I really do enjoy listening. Well, Andrea, I have a treat for you that Peter can talk about a little bit, which is the museum. We've mentioned this on the air. The museum is going to be doing a series of food fora. I guess that's a plural for forum, where we get experts in different fields, food-related fields, on opposite sides of different issues, including nutrition questions, things like the soda ban in New York, and kind of what the evidence is on whether or not that's even a useful thing or a good thing. Things like, what other subjects are we going to tackle, Peter?
Looking at the marketing of snack foods, also GMO seeds. And basically, take any controversial food issue where you've got a lot of really strong opinions out there. Bringing all these people together for a discussion and to allow people to see the different points of view and come to their own conclusions.
Right. And so, what we hope is that this is going to be a bastion of kind of no BS straight duty. We're going to get people from different sides of the debate who are all smart, no idiots, and get them together, moderate them, and try to have some actual interesting food discussion. A lot of it's going to be centered around nutrition, just because that's such an important topic today. And there's just so much misinformation out there. Because, all the information that you get presented is presented by someone who has an axe to grind. Don't you think so, Peter?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I mean, I have an axe to grind, too, but my axe to grind is that everyone else has an axe to grind. But guess that is its own axe, right?
I'll say either
kind of a meta-axe.
Yeah, meta-axe. I'd say meta-axe. Either an axe to grind or a commercial interest.
Yeah, or some combination. Yeah. Some combination thereof. Okay, Vivian Mack writes in, question for the show. She writes it on Twitter, actually. Why do some egg whites, when they make macaroon, what's the difference, what's the effect of age egg whites on foam, drainage, and volume? Well, I looked at an article called The Hen Age and Egg Storage Time for Egg Albumin Foaming by Marianne Hammersurge.
Dave, you have another caller.
Oh, yeah? Okay. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, Dave. I'll be brief here since we're running out of time. Falafel. I'm having repeated falafel disasters. It either instantly burns or just completely disintegrates in the oil.
Yes, that is true. There's nothing more depressing than making the falafel ball and then sticking it into the oil, having it completely dissolve, and then form a layer of burnt crap on the bottom of your fryer.
Check. Yes.
Yeah, that's horrible. It happens to me all the time, and I did at one point research a good recipe, and I had my falafels down. But I'm hesitant to just, like, over the air give a bunch of things, because I want to remember exactly how I downed them. I think one of my main problems was I really like tahini flavor a lot, and so I think I put a lot of it into the chickpea mix that I put in, and so I think the oil, and plus I didn't add a lot of external binder to it, and they just blew apart. And then I moved to try to chill the batter first in the, you know, par freeze a little bit so that they'd hold well before the crust set up. And I went through a whole bunch of rigmaroles, but I'm going to try to figure out exactly what I did. And if Natasha can write a note, I'll try to talk about it on next week's program when I have a little more time to gather my thoughts on it. But you're correct. There's nothing more depressing, well, a few things more depressing, than watching your falafel balls fall apart in the fryer and sink to the bottom.
Yes. Thank you very much.
All right. So we'll deal with that guy next week. All right, so back to the importance of hen age and egg storage time from 2000, and I'll just read you the abstract. The ferment and fraction of egg albumin had different foaming properties. I'll give you the upshot. The thin white foams more, i.e. has more overrun, can take more air into it. But the thick white produces a more stable foam, right? So you can't win. And so the more you age things, the more the egg whites, more of the thick white is converted into thin white. But also, the foaming properties of it depend on the age of the hen when the hen lays the egg. And that's something you can't control anyway. So really, there's no way to win. There's another article, if you want, you can go look at that deals with the problem of meringue specifically. It's called The Effect of Sugar, Citric Acid, and Egg White Types on the Microstructural and Mechanical Properties of Meringues, which came out relatively recently. But I think all of this stuff is kind of missing the point. The best thing I read about it was on a website called Macaron Mythbusters on the blog www.bravepart.com. By the way, we're not talking about macaroons here. We're talking about the French meringue-based cookies with the jelly in between, which I freaking love. Do you guys like those things?
No, not really.
What the hell? You don't like those either? What do you not like about those? Peter, you like those things, right?
Sorry, man.
You don't like them?
Well, actually, I don't... it's been so long since I've had one. But I'm not... I don't have much of a sweet tooth.
What the hell's wrong with you people? Why don't you like it, Stas? Is it because it reminds you how delicious a biscuit is?
No, same as Peter, like, I haven't had one in a long time, so it's not like I care that much about them. So maybe that's the thing. I just don't care.
So it's not that you don't like them, it's just you don't care about them.
Right.
But if someone put it in front of you, you're not like, no thanks.
No, I'll eat it.
Yeah, all right, well, you guys are freaking weirdos. I think they're delicious. Anyway, Brave Tart, and I don't know who it is, did a series of tests. And here's what Braveheart writes, which I really like. Every day I changed a single variable across multiple batches. And Braveheart was making them professionally for somebody, for several months. Every day was pumping out these things, and so I had a lot of opportunity to test. and said I changed single variable across multiple batches, generally three, and noted my results. I also tested variables by their absence. For example, I listened to Huey Lewis in the news every time I made macaroon. The macaroon turned out fabulous. Then I made a few batches without the power of love because these all, and then these also turned out beautifully. So I can at least conclude that Huey Lewis didn't play an essential role in the matter of making macaroon. And I think that's kind of a great test. You know, maybe it was the Huey Lewis. And Braveheart here is what Braveheart is basically saying is that a lot of these things that people take for granted or take as rules, making them, like you have to age your egg whites first, or you have to dry out them after you pipe them before you cook them, aren't necessarily dried in stone. And Bravetart's point, and I have to keep saying their name because I don't know if it's a he or a she, but Bravetart's point is basically that if you have proper technique and you know what a proper meringue looks like and the proper egg white foam looks like, then you can get that egg white foam. You can get a proper result, right? If your technique is good, whether you dry it after you pipe it or you don't, because that's basically controlling moisture. A lot of the techniques that are used are controlling the moisture content of the batter before it's piped. So drying controls the spread of the macaron and the moisture content by letting some moisture flash off. Ditto with the aging the egg whites. And by the way, back to Vivian Mack's question, aging the egg whites can mean several things. It can mean using aged egg whites, i.e., aged eggs, that is, eggs that are older and therefore also have a higher pH and more thin white, and also possibly more protein density because some water is evaporated. It could also mean cracking the eggs out in advance and then letting moisture flash off the top of the egg white to also increase protein density. Either one of those things could be meant by aging. I'm not sure which one you mean or which one anyone really means when they're talking about it. But the big point here is that all of the variables about the age of the egg whites can just be swamped and drowned out if you just perfect your actual technique. So I would go read Bravetart's macaroon section, macaron section rather, and see what they said. So very quickly, because I know I am running out of time because I have to make it to my Uncle Luke's 100th birthday. You don't want to be late to a 100th birthday party, am I right?
Right.
I mean, he's 100. So last time I saw Uncle Luke, he was 98. And he's still clipping along. Saw him yesterday, you know, just in case. But yeah, never been to a 100th birthday. Oldest relative I've ever had. Do you have anyone that's close to 100?
No.
Family ever?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Peter?
Yeah, he's down here in Florida living the kind of dehydrated Florida life, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, so Scott from Guelph. You know, we love Guelph. Never been, but like I always say, awesome university up there, Dairy Science, writes in, saw an interesting link about the polymerization, the polymer gelation of oils, and the patent number for those of you that want to look at it, it's a patent link, is EP244006H1, and says Dave was talking to three Japanese people to sell oil products, thought this might be relevant. Now, we were talking before about this Japanese product, some people wrote in about that you could add to oil in the pan. It solidifies it so you could throw it away as a block. It's kind of cool. But this is kind of a cool technique. Maybe we should talk about it more next week, where they're actually using not methyl cellulose like we use in normal cooking, ethyl cellulose. And the deal with ethyl cellulose as opposed to methyl cellulose is ethyl cellulose is not soluble in water. It's not a hydrocolloid. It's soluble in oil. But it's although it's not a hydrocolloid, it's not soluble in water, it is exactly analogous to hydrocolloids in water. But so you disperse ethyl cellulose in oil, heat it up to a much higher temperature than you do most water-based cells, 140 Celsius. It dissolves in, cools, and forms a gel where the liquid phase is actually liquid oil and not liquid water. I've experimented with them, but it's pretty cool, and they have a lot of potential uses in being able to replace trans fats. Anyway, okay. This question before we gotta go. Yo, Jack, got a question for the show and something for you to laugh at. This is from Dane and Siska. And I'll first give you the one that they sent me to laugh at. He knows that we enjoy funk and hip hop and all this kind of stuff. So, and I was not aware of this website, but sent us a link to, it's called Gizoogle, and basically they take they take any, it's like Google, but they somehow use Google Translate functionality, and they translate any, they translate anything into Snoop Dogg's kind of like, you know, shizzle for shizzle language. So they sent us a link to cooking issues, Heritage Radio cooking issues, splash page done in shizzle language. And it is an interesting, fun to do search as long as you're, you know, as long as you're not offended by people dropping a lot of F-bombs. It is to do a search. But back to his quick questions. He has two questions. One, he's going to have to run this next week because I don't understand it. Questions are, number one, Western sauce, WTF. I've never heard of Western sauce. You ever heard of Western sauce, Nas or Peter?
No.
I have no idea what that is.
Western North Carolina versus Eastern North Carolina barbecue sauce, in which case, I'm with you, WTF, who wants that Western North Carolina barbecue sauce? No offense, Lexington, North Carolina, because I'll tell you something, the Eastern North Carolina barbecue sauce, which is vinegar and red pepper only, way to be. And, you know, I hate coming down on anyone that lives, you know, kind of in the Piedmont area of North Carolina and likes to add a little bit of tomato in their otherwise delicious pulled pork barbecue with kind of tomato sauce. But, you know, there's kind of like, there's a right and a wrong there, and I believe Eastern North Carolina sauce is right. I don't think that's what they're referring to. Probably going to get in trouble for that. The second question there, oh, and by the way, you know how a couple weeks ago I came out against barbecue sauce because in general I'm against it? Do you remember that stuff?
Yeah.
Do you know who Victor Gable Williams is?
You're sort of fading out and in.
Oh, do you know who Victor Gable Williams is?
No.
Gunter Gable Williams was the most famous animal trainer like the Ringling Brothers ever had. And he's been down here, and I had a chance to taste his steak sauce, and I have to say it was pretty good. Check out Gunter Gable Williams' steak sauce. You take scotch, you saute a bunch of onions, and then you throw in a bunch of scotch, and then you throw in a bunch of Worcestershire sauce, and then you throw in a little bit of brown sugar, and a little bit of mustard, and a little bit of Worcestershire sauce. And I have to say, actually, like, it's pretty good. It's more of a jus. That's a sweet barbecue sauce and more of a jus. Anyway, all right, so it looks like it's all the good stuff we got, right, Stas?
Yep.
All right, we're out. I'm going to report on my Uncle Luke's 100th birthday when I come back. Sweet cooking issues. Remember to back Kickstarter. Bye.
Yeah, Dave, one more plug. One more plug, man.
What?
So, yeah, we really appreciate you guys' support. Means a lot to us. Really need your help. So, and we need to raise the money we need for the exhibit by July 20. If we don't get the support we need, this is really just not going to happen. So please get on to boom.mofed.org. Thank you.
Do it now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.